Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, while there won't be a red carpet, Eureka Springs will recognize achievement in independent film this weekend.
Plus, an exhibit allowing patrons to get hands-on with some of the first pages and books ever printed.
Plus, Becca Martin Brown talks haggis. But first, in advance of elections this year, a new poll out yesterday looks at the most important issues for Arkansas voters. The survey was conducted by Talk Business Arkansas and Hendricks College. Roby Brock has details.
More than 5 years after the start of the recession, still the most important issue facing Arkansans today by a large margin is the economy and jobs. So you still see folks kind of feeling the repercussions of this from our latest Talk Business Hendricks College survey. We found that 55% identified the economy and jobs as their most important issue. A second, distant second, was healthcare at 16%, education at 14%. So you can see the distance between that one top issue versus what might be most relevant to someone else beyond that.
He says the economy being in the forefront of voters' minds at the beginning of an election year puts considerable pressure on candidates running for office.
Particularly the candidates for governor, to lay out a very clear vision of how they will improve the economy, how they will create more jobs. I think you will see the top candidates on the Republican side in Asa Hutchinson and the top Democrat, only announced candidate at this point in time, Mike Ross, really talk about the jobs and the economy because of what we see in these polling numbers.
The poll of 520 likely voters also asked respondents if they felt that Arkansas is headed in the right direction. Nearly half, 48%, said the state is heading in the right direction, while 36% said it is moving in the wrong direction, and 16% said they didn't know. Additional polling data will be released today.
Officials with the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad are still trying to determine the cause of a failed bridge raising mechanism nearly 3 days after a pair of cables malfunctioned and left one end of the bridge raised. Ron Sparks is the chief of the railroad's police force, and he is managing the repair efforts at the Arkansas River Bridge near Van Buren.
Of course, this bridge was built in 1969, and those cables have been there since then. But they are maintenance and lubricated and things of that nature on an annual basis at least. And then they are inspected, and we inspect the bridge monthly. But we don't know yet what caused the cables to break. Our engineers and specialists are still trying to determine that. The status today is we have manpower and parts and equipment and heavy equipment here. We have more equipment coming to be in the water as far as barges and cranes to help us get this bridge up, so that we can resume river traffic, of course, is a big issue, and then the train traffic as well.
He says a bridge malfunction like this is unusual for the railroad.
Well, I've been here 16 years, and this has never happened since I've been here, and I don't know of it happening any time since we've owned this bridge, nothing to this degree, which we've had it for going on 28 years. So we haven't experienced anything like this. You know, occasionally things will go wrong with it, but it's usually an electronical problem or something we can fix fairly quickly. Nothing that stops river traffic or rail traffic, because the bridge can be mainly ran from a motor that's on top of the bridge, even if the electronics go out. So we have ways to operate it. This is the first time we've had this kind of an issue that I know of.
Spark says the goal for today is to get the bridge fully lowered and locked so all of the old cables across the bridge can be removed and replaced. Once the bridge is lowered, Spark says limited rail and river traffic can resume. Although dealing with a bridge malfunction of this magnitude is new to the railroad, Sparks estimated it would take about a week for the necessary repair work to be completed, provided no other problems are encountered in that process.
Cargill Meat Solutions has agreed to pay $2.2 million as part of a settlement of hiring discrimination allegations. The U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs made the allegations, which pertain to three of the meat processors' plants, including the turkey slaughter and processing facility in Springdale. According to the CityWire, Cargill will pay into a settlement fund, even though Cargill officials deny any claims that the company discriminated against any applicants, claiming that the federal auditing body unfairly uses a quota system in applying the law.
After failing to meet employment expectations tied to receiving state economic incentive money, Hewlett-Packard is scheduled to refund $459,000 to the state of Arkansas. According to Talk Business Arkansas, HP received roughly $10 million in incentives from the governor's Quick Action Closing Fund as part of an agreement to create 1,000 jobs within 5 years at the company's tech support facility in Conway. However, last year, HP laid off about 500 workers before announcing it would hire 200 other workers with different skill sets. Because of the net employment decline, officials with the Arkansas Economic Development Commission say HP failed to meet all of the requirements of the incentives deal, and HP is required to make reparations to the state. The HP facility currently employs between 700 and 900 people.
21C Museum Hotel in Bentonville continues to garner awards. Yesterday, TripAdvisor, a travel planning and review website, ranked 21C the sixth best hotel in the nation in the site's 2014 Traveler's Choice Top 25 Hotels ranking. Of the top 10 hotels on the list, three are in Oregon, two are in California, and one each in New York, Colorado, Hawaii, and South Carolina.
The dry and windy weather continues across Arkansas. At least 28 counties in the state are now under burn bans, including Benton, Carroll, Boone, Washington, Franklin, Johnson, and Logan counties. Additionally, the National Weather Service in Tulsa has issued a fire weather watch for tomorrow for Benton, Carroll, Washington, and Madison counties. According to the alert, strong winds will develop tomorrow with gusts up to 30 miles per hour during the afternoon, and a dry air mass will remain in place with relative humidities falling to as low as 20%.
And the forecast calls for mostly clear skies tonight with overnight lows from 4 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 10 degrees and wind chill values as low as 4 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, sunny with highs from 35 and wind chills as low as negative 6 in northwest Arkansas. Mostly clear tomorrow night with overnight lows from 29 in northwest Arkansas to 24 in the Arkansas River Valley.
The University of Arkansas Fort Smith has been no stranger to headlines of late, from the development of the college's 20-year master plan to a shift toward offering bachelor degrees in nursing. And as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, more change on the horizon in the form of a new degree program.
Just more than a decade ago, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith officially joined the University of Arkansas system. At that time, the college, then known as West Ark Community College, had offerings common to community colleges, mostly trade-related certificate and associate's degree programs, and many students who attended West Ark took general education courses before transferring to a four-year institution. But since 2002, UAFS has transformed into a four-year college, and the university's offerings have grown to include about 40 different majors, many of which offer bachelor's degrees. However, if everything goes according to plan, UAFS will begin offering its first master's degree at about the 2015 academic year. Dr. Ray Wallace, provost and senior vice chancellor of the university, says that the push to begin offering graduate degree programs began about 2 years ago with inquiries to the UAFS College of Health Professions. But he says that just starting a master's degree program isn't simple, as UAFS is accredited as a four-year institution.
To offer our first graduate program, we have to change the role and scope of the university, and that has to be approved at the same time as you propose the program. And it goes all the way from the University of Arkansas System Board to the Arkansas Department of Higher Education Board and then to the Higher Learning Commission of the North Central Association. And so that's three major steps.
Wallace says that the first step went well for UAFS. The University of Arkansas Board unanimously approved the college's proposal to begin developing the master's degree in healthcare administration. With phase one out of the way, Wallace says that university officials are moving on to step two in the process.
Now what we're doing at this moment is we're waiting on the Arkansas Department of Higher Education to get a committee together of outside evaluators. Those would be people from administrators, deans of healthcare administration, graduate programs, that type of thing, to come down to the university to look at our facilities, to look at our library, to look at our faculty credentials, all of that. And that will happen sometime this early spring.
If that meeting goes well, then another team of Arkansas College deans and administrators will pay a visit and forward its recommendations to the full board of the Arkansas Department of Higher Education. Even then, the North Central Association of the Higher Learning Commission, which is the college's accrediting body, must give its approval of UAFS's plans.
Then we have the Higher Learning Commission sends one or two people to our campus to do a thorough evaluation of what our strengths are vis-a-vis offering this graduate program.
But what exactly will all of these teams of evaluators be looking for when they visit the UAFS campus?
It is important that we are able to show all the bodies that come in to look at us, all those committees, all those evaluators, that we have a very current library, good resources, obviously great faculty, and a curriculum that meets the needs of the regional and, frankly, the national market. And we have that. We have just expanded our library, pretty much doubled our library. Our faculty are very good. We have very solid endowed professorships that we're filling right now, and so that's very solid. And the support, frankly, from the River Valley and Oklahoma and beyond for this program has been quite astonishing, to be quite honest.
If that sounds like a drawn-out process, then you're right. But Wallace says that that's precisely the point.
It's a very critical process because universities, when they change their role and scope, when they move from the ability to offer one type of degree to another, to a higher degree, that first step in that is very deliberate. Some might say slow, but I would say deliberate. And it's an important step in the evolution of this university.
To that end, UAFS Chancellor Paul Barron has been quoted as saying that developing the master's degree in healthcare administration is one of the most important steps in the development of the university.
And I would agree with that. The ability for us to begin to offer selective graduate programs, obviously starting with the master's in healthcare administration, is of massive importance, not just to the university itself, obviously, but also to the economic development and well-being of the community we serve.
In keeping with the community's needs, the new master's program will be an online learning experience, allowing current healthcare professionals to take 33 hours of health and business courses while they continue to work. Wallace says that the choice to make it an online program, rather than a traditional on-campus experience, was a deliberate one.
You know, that's part of the needs analysis that came back when we started surveying folks. And that's what any school within the University of Arkansas system does. There's a lot of surveying and questionnaires to make sure that the degree program that we're offering the community is, in fact, a degree program that, A, they can use, and, B, they can access. And these are all, you know, the people interested in this. We're not talking about people who are not professionals. They're all professionals in the field. And they want advanced degrees for promotions, for advancement in their jobs, for new jobs, and that's why we do that.
And although he couldn't say for sure what other master's degree programs UAFS might develop in the future, Wallace says that offering more graduate degrees fits in well with the campus's master plan.
We have just rolled out the newest model of our master plan. Met with good success, good response from the community and from the university. And part and parcel of that is a graduate program or a series of graduate programs so that we can increase our enrollment in those areas. We will always be primarily focused at the undergraduate level, but we will have, I would imagine we would have selective graduate programs over the next 10 years. Yeah, obviously to increase enrollment in that area. But those will always be community-driven, meeting the needs first and foremost of our primary audience in this area.
But before any of those other programs are considered, Wallace says that University of Arkansas Fort Smith officials first want to get final approval for the master's degree program in healthcare administration. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
From exit to sale, to those identifying a place of business or a home address, signs help us humans make our way through the world.
So I went to buy my stepdad a Christmas gift, And there was this new book that was out called Sign Painters. And it was all about all of these old school women and men who have painted signs. I read it before I gave it to him, and I sort of became obsessed. I wanted to learn the process. I wanted to use nice brushes, and I wanted to use enamel instead of just, you know, craft paint. I've just sort of latched onto it. It's kind of all I want to do.
In just about 25 minutes here on Ozarks at Large, we visit the workshop of sign maker Sleep City Ozarks.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, after years of economic trouble and painful cutbacks, state governors are delivering annual addresses that are full of hope and optimism for the future. We'll check in on the state of the states. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now follows Ozarks at Large. It begins at 1 o'clock on 91.3 FM.
This spring, you can get up close to a copy of the first public printing of President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. You can closely study a 1350 copy of the Magna Carta, see a 17th century Italian edition of Marco Polo's account of his journey across Asia 400 years before, or hold a page from a Gutenberg Bible. These documents and many others are part of a collection on display through early May at Mullins Library at the University of Arkansas. The exhibit, free and open to the public, is on loan from the Remnant Trust in Indiana. Some of the earliest copies of works by Thomas Paine, Mary Wollstonecraft, and Thomas Jefferson are included. This week, I talked to Molly Boyd, assistant to the Dean of Libraries at the University of Arkansas, about the rare pieces of history on campus this semester. The assortment represents a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to experience language and ideas.
Exactly. We're excited, too. The materials that are collected here from the Remnant Trust, in most cases, is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see and even touch these original works.
Well, let's talk about that word touch, because that's something the Remnant Trust talks about in their material, that this is an idea that you can touch. So what does that mean? What can people do with these documents at Mullins Library?
Well, it's not that they can just toss them around, but we are going to provide 2 hours a day where we have staff on hand that will allow them to take the materials out of the cases one at a time and just look through them, see what they see. And there's so much to see in the actual physical item that you don't see from just the text online, let's say.
So, boy, it's a lot of different things here from the 17th, 16th, 15th century. This goes back to the printed word's earliest days.
Not only that, but the earliest days of language. We have some terracotta pieces that have cuneiform written on them, so those are 4,000 years old.
Wow. A page from a Gutenberg Bible?
Yes, we have that. Just one page, and the Remnant Trust says it's really hard to calculate how, you know, what the value of that is, because it's so rare, being the first printed book.
How are they're here for the majority of this semester. How are you allowing people to interact with them? Where are they at this time?
The materials are located in Mullins Library in an exhibit. They're, you can look at it at any time. The cases are locked. But 2 hours during the weekdays, we have staff on hand to unlock the cases at the request of patrons and to show these materials and allow them just to explore them. They have different bindings, different printings. Some of them are, of course, handwritten manuscripts. The materials on which they made these vary from rice paper to parchment to vellum. So it's very interesting to see all of those variations, as well as there it is. There's the specific, you know, King James Version of the Bible, first printing.
Oh, my gosh. How did this come about? How did you make connection to the Remnant Trust?
A professor of social work, Scott Bertram, had seen this exhibit in Mississippi, and he came to the Dean of Libraries, Carolyn Allen, and asked her, can we please get this here, because it is really a life-changing experience to hold these things in your hands. And she agreed, and we pursued it.
How did they arrive? I mean, I have this vision of people in white gloves and very carefully bringing things in from an armored van. Am I over romanticizing?
You are indeed.
No.
The head of the trust, Chris Bex, brought them personally. And he brought them by truck.
Just like?
Just like. Here's a couple of boxes of priceless books. Of course, they're packed in specially made boxes for each piece and then packed again in other boxes. So it's fairly secure.
There is an opportunity for people to learn more about some of the subjects and some of the actual documents that are here. You're going to have a series of conversations or lectures too, right?
We're very fortunate that the professors at the university really took on this idea and have made it their own. We've got a number of lectures where professors are going to talk about the significance of a work or an era or a topic that's related to one or more of the materials in the exhibit.
This is a spectacular collection. How do you know much about how the Remnant Trust began their quest to collect ideas?
They have a manifesto that has to do with freedom and liberty, and from a very American perspective. So they started with things like Thomas Paine and the Articles of Confederation. But as they began to collect those materials, they started thinking of other opportunities to collect ideas that changed the way we viewed the world. And specifically, that has to do with freedom of thought, freedom of expression. So we have Galileo and Copernicus in the exhibit as a good example of that idea.
You mentioned, we've talked about the Gutenberg Bible, the King James Version, but there is an Egyptian scroll fragment of the Torah from 17th, 16th century, a manuscript of the Quran from the late 18th century, a 16th century copy of the Illustrated Life of Confucius. I mean, this, you can't sum up the world, perhaps, in one exhibit, but you can make a pretty good dent.
Some really nice cultures that are represented there, and we do have one of the professor lectures is going to talk about the Illustrated Life of Confucius, which there again, Confucius didn't create his own works. Works were written about him after he was deceased. But this is a lovely example of an illustrated manuscript from China.
As you and I talk, the exhibit has been open for just a few hours. Have you had a chance to look at the material yet?
Yes, very much so.
What's that like?
It's wonderful. From the bookworm holes that you see in some of the books to the different bindings, to there's actually one work that was printed but was never illuminated. So there are like big gaps before every paragraph where the initial letter was supposed to be drawn in, but that part was never done. There's a book in there that's never been cut, so the pages are just printed and aligned, but then the edges are just seems like a random accumulation of different size pieces of paper.
This is free, right?
It is.
People can bring their family and look
yes,
at this.
Yes, and we would love to have them do that. It's free and open to the public. You can come see the materials at any time the library is open, which is from generally 7 a.m. in the morning till 2 a.m. at night. But we only have staff on hand 2 hours a day to open the cases and allow you to look at the materials hands-on.
Molly Boyd is the assistant to the Dean of Libraries at the University of Arkansas. This week, an exhibit of rare documents from the Remnant Trust was installed inside Mullins Library and will remain on display during library hours until early May. The exhibit is free and open to the public. You can learn more about the exhibit and the opportunities to inspect the documents closer by going to the website libinfo.uark.edu. That's libinfo.uark.edu. Then follow the exhibits link. This is Ozarks at Large.
The Golden Globes were just a couple of weeks ago, and in just a few more, movie lovers will tune in to the Academy Awards. During this awards season, locals can head to the Odd in Eureka Springs, as Outstanding Achievements and Independent Film will be recognized during the inaugural Eureka Springs Indie Film Fest. Teresa DeVito is a co-founder of the three-day event, which begins today. The idea came from an effort to resurrect the city during an oft-quiet winter period, but it has grown so much since that original thought. DeVito says film is a great love of hers.
I've had a chance to work on some movies, just real small, local type things, some in Fayetteville, some in Eureka. And it's just fun, no matter what I'm doing on the film. I find behind the camera, in front of the camera, it's just so much fun to create.
She herself has entered a film in the festival.
And it's called A Life on the Day Of. And the byline is, they say your life flashes before your eyes. And when people ask me what it's about, I say it's about life.
DeVito is a co-founder, not a judge. Judges were chosen due to their film connections. Many have their own production companies in places like Florida and California, but also have a love for Eureka, a perfect fit for this festival. Judges received over 30 submissions from around the country. Entries were not limited to this area. A first viewing was conducted, and a point system was used to narrow the films down to 23 finalists, varying in length from less than 10 minutes to almost 2 hours in six categories.
The categories are art, comedy, drama, documentary, cause-related documentary, and animation. I kept it really wide so that locals would have a lot of options, not be tied to just one type. We may streamline that a little bit more as the festival continues on through the years.
Originally from Great Britain, Adrian Frost entered three films, two of which were accepted into the art category. He studied at the St. Martin School of Art in London in the 1960s, where he dabbled in film a bit, but got sidetracked with painting, sculpture, poetry, teaching, and performance until just over 2 years ago, when he brought back his passion for film. He talked at great length about the first of his two films, The Return. It's a collaboration with a young artist, Ada Z. Athorpe. The two happened to meet at an exhibit in Brooklyn. After hearing a poem by Frost, The Truth, Athorpe thought of a poem she herself had written, but was reluctant to recite it until a cab ride back to Frost's studio.
I didn't know. It was in Spanish. I don't speak Spanish. So she started the poem, and as luck would have it, we had a Latino taxi driver, and he started to translate. And she got to this bit where she said, in Spanish, what she said, and he says, "And if you throw me, make it out the window, and I'll fly back." And I thought, good God, it's great. I got to have it.
At the time, he didn't know what he was going to do with it, but he filmed Athorpe reciting her poem, If You Want Me, on the balcony of his Brooklyn studio. As she spoke, she was translating the words from Spanish to English, leaving a gap between lines and verses, something Frost likes because it made it less of a read poem and more someone trying to find the words, leaving space for him to record his own words in a friend's studio in Eureka Springs and weave them with Athorpe's.
The truth.
Put energy. Is trunk. Yours.
The trunk.
If you want me.
Was hidden.
Be careful.
Hidden deep. In the drift.
For.
They were making love.
The world moves.
The heat. Of her buttocks.
In a.
Melting. The ice.
He references a Venn diagram. Circles that overlap one another to show how two things are different in the separate portions, yet similar in the overlapping area. An image that is used throughout the film, particularly in the black and white introduction. Frost's words are written about his late wife, and whom the film is dedicated, Jan Beaver Galeone, yet another female artist Frost has worked with. Galeone died in a car crash 20 years ago.
I'd written about her before, but I tried to change the way I was writing in the last year and try and just not try and write anything pretty or even care about it being a poem, but try and find out what the hell was going on in my gnarly old heart and soul before everything's over. Well, what her poem seems to do, Ada Athorpe's poem seems to do, when they come together, they change one another. And hope comes out of this.
His words in the film have almost an echoey wah, wah, wah kind of sound to them. He says that he is like the narrator in the story of male versus female, that he's like the world, and she is flitting and fleeting around it.
So me, I think I was trying to, we were trying to get the feeling of this sort of epic thing, the boy, just like an echoing kind of manifest, almost a sort of darkness that gets relieved by her.
The sound starts as soon as the film begins, with a didgeridoo played by a friend. He says the basis of his films are words, and he is rarely the one wielding the camera. However, The Return opens with about 20 seconds that Frost shot, really by accident, he says, as the camera was shoved into his hands. The images are of an industrial-like staircase, much like a city firescape. The remainder of the film was shot by A. Thorpe at her home in Maine. Flashing images of toes in a creek bed, fire in a wood stove, and snow can be seen. As it turns out, the car crash that killed Frost's wife occurred in a snowstorm.
Ada was shooting film, and the snow came. The snow came in that night, and she went out. And that bit you see of her is when she she lies in the snow. So she went out and shot that. The snow came for us. So it does not make a good film, but it does make the... It gives one an opportunity.
The Return is just under 10 minutes and entered into the art category. Frost's second film, You Must Know Something, is based on a chance encounter with a homeless veteran on the banks of the Mississippi River in Memphis. It will also be judged in the Eureka Springs Indie Film Fest. Frost thanks and recognizes all of the collaborators on these films. Up next for Adrian Frost and his team is a film dedicated to Dylan Thomas, whose centennial will be celebrated in England next year. The Return will be shown during the locals portion of the film fest beginning at 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. Yes, Frost has called Eureka home for the past 5 years and is considered a local. The Eureka Springs Indie Film Fest began today at the auditorium and will continue tomorrow and Saturday with screenings of films from around the region, the state, and the country, along with panel discussions and an award show Saturday evening. For the lineup, tickets, or for more information, visit esindiefilmfest.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Not everything is made in our listening area. There are some things that are not made here.
No. Well, there are a lot of things that are made here.
Exactly. And as we continue our once-a-month series on locally made, we found out that some of those objects that direct you one place or another are also made here.
The one-woman business of Sleet City Hand-Painted Signs has only been around for just over a year, yet Olivia Trimble's products have been all over, including a banner that was hung outside the town center in Fayetteville for the Little Craft Show, and a sandwich board for Onyx Coffee Lab. Olivia realized that she could make a business of painting signs after she bought her stepfather, a lifelong sign painter, Eric Snodgrass of Snodgrass Signs, a book for Christmas.
It was a combination of me sort of trying out some different little flea market booth ideas. So I was doing furniture and it was going really well. And when I would look at like things like Pinterest, I would see signs that people were making. So I thought, well, I can maybe do that. So I tried it, and I really liked it. And so I did like the arts and crafts signs for quite a while, just for friends and for like teeny tiny little events. And then they started getting popular. So I went to buy my stepdad a Christmas gift, and there was this new book that was out called Sign Painters, and it was all about all of these old school women and men who have painted signs. I read it before I gave it to him, and I sort of became obsessed. I wanted to learn the process. I wanted to use nice brushes, and I wanted to use enamel instead of just, you know, craft paint. I've just sort of latched onto it. It's kind of all I want to do.
Sleet City Hand Painted Signs is based out of Olivia's home in the south side of Fayetteville, where she lives with her husband and two young children. The studio? Her garage. She credits staying home with her two young children for helping her realize that she could make hand-painted signs her livelihood.
I've tried a few different things. I took some classes at the U of A and went to hair school for a while, and nothing really seemed very interesting. And all the while, I was staying at home with our two daughters, Eleanor and Callie. And so it just occurred to me that, like, sign painting is a trade. It's something that people have to take a long time to learn. So, like, what better time for me to figure out what I want to do and start learning it than now?
Right now, Olivia is working on a custom order for a good friend. It's a sign painted on barn wood where she's made a custom sign frame. The quote she is painting onto the rough surface of barn wood comes from a Kris Kristofferson song. My thirsty wanted whiskey, but my hungry needed beans.
I basically have printed the paper pattern to fit her sign. I've chalked the back and laid her pattern down on the sign, and I'm basically just tracing the line so that I have a guide for when I paint. There are some jobs where I would do something freehand, but for this specific project, we decided on a specific look, and we're just sticking with it. I'll be using one-shot lettering enamel on the sign, and I'll be using my sign painting lettering quills, and the kind that I use are matte brushes. A lot of times when I pull up the pattern and expect to see my chalk outline underneath, I just have to go off of indentations in the wood. So there's some of that on the sign today. The way that lettering enamel works is that you thin it with paint thinner. So that's what I'll be doing next. I'm gonna test this paint out and see how it works on our barn wood here. So my brushes are made from squirrel tail. So every time I clean them and put them up, they are, I guess, conditioned with oil. Every time I pull a brush out to paint, I have to clean it with paint thinner. So my workshop's pretty smelly place. Painting on barn wood is always a challenge. The texture is just crazy. If it were smooth, it might go a little faster, but because I'm taking the texture into consideration, it takes a little more coaxing to get the enamel down into the grooves of this wood. There are some signs that I can do very quickly, but my work time is usually about anywhere from 35 minutes to an hour for like a medium-sized piece like this. But that doesn't really take into consideration like the design and layout, and then if I have to actually construct anything.
The sign Olivia's wrapping up will go to a private home, but you can check out her wares at the Four-Legged Bird in Fayetteville. That's at the Archibald Yell S Curve. Also, check her out on Facebook at Sleet City Decor. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
It was wintertime in Nashville, down on Music City Road. I was looking for a place to get myself out of the cold, to warm the frozen feeling that was eating at my soul. Keep the chilly wind off of my guitar. My thirsty wanted whiskey, my hungry needed beans. But it's been a month of payday since I'd heard that.
This Week in This American Life. A storage container filled with somebody else's stuff. Can't go inside or touch it.
Oh my God!
It looks empty.
No, there's someone living back there.
But you can look. bid on what you think it's worth.
There's so much hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
What it's like to actually make a living doing this, guessing, this week.
Listen to This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUAF.
To become an accountant, one must go to business school, then take the CPA exam. To become a lawyer, one goes to law school, then takes the bar exam. But how does one become a police officer? I visited the Rogers Police Department to find out. The Rogers Police Department employs 96 officers, but the city allows for them to have 105 officers. Next month, on February 6th, the department will be holding an entry-level police officer examination, and they're looking for people from all walks of life to try out. Potential officers must be at least a 21-year-old U.S. citizen with no felonies and at least a high school degree. Keith Foster is the communications officer with the Rogers Police Department. He says the biggest requirement is to have a good character.
You know, for us, character, integrity, that's kind of the, that's everything in our career. And everything we do is based off our integrity. And once we lose that integrity, we're ineffective as an officer. We can teach you the skills to be a police officer, but we can't teach someone to have good character. They either have it or they don't.
Being a policeman is much more than blue lights and a badge. Good communication skills are key.
You're either on the scene somewhere and you're talking with someone and you're trying to find out exactly what happened, you know, to get their side of the story. And you have to be, you know, work one way with victims. And then when you get someone that's a suspect, you know, then you kind of may kick into an interrogation phase. And so being able to make those transitions back and forth and being able to talk to them in the different ways. And then let's say you go through and you figure everything out and you go ahead and you arrest the suspect in that. Well, then you've got to come back and you've got to be able to write a good report.
It doesn't matter how well an investigation was conducted if a proper report cannot be written. A bad report means a bad guy is going to go free. Foster says a good officer will write everything down in anticipation of legal scrutiny.
The judge sees them, the defense sees them, the prosecution sees them, and they go through and they get nitpicked. So we have to make sure that when we're going through and doing those reports, everything is in there, that we do everything accurate, and we try to put as much in there as possible because, you know, for us, when we get on in court, if it's not in the report, it didn't happen. You can't sit there and later say, oh, wait, I remember this. Well, it's not in the report, so that does you no good.
Foster says about 50 people will sign up to take the test, and of those, 35 will actually show up on February 6th. The written exam consists of English, following directions, attention to detail, and ability to follow a map. When finished, the written test is graded immediately, and while it's being graded, the prospects head outside for physical agility testing.
You'll start from the ground with a kneeling position, and you'll stand up. You'll run over, you'll run up and down a flight of stairs a couple times, kind of, you know, getting your heart rate up. Then we have a machine that we kind of go over that you get to fight with. And then from there, you'll do a sprint for a certain distance. Then you'll come back. We have a body drag, which is basically a dummy, and you've got to drag it so many feet. Now, it's supposed to be, I think, like 180 pounds, but come on, it's got wet sand in there, so it's probably closer to 200 somewhere in there. And then after you've done all that, you're exhausted, you got your heart rate up, we've got to stand with basically it's a bar with a circle on top, and we have a pistol, and you'll pull the pistol 17 times with one hand and then switch the other and then do 16 on that. And just to see, can you keep it in the circle? After you've got your heart rate up, can you calm yourself enough to be able to do that?
It's an unloaded gun, but in the line of duty, there will be bullets. An officer would also have on a bulletproof vest, so the test takers must also don one. It weighs about 20 pounds. The department will lose about 10 prospects in this testing stage, leaving 25 remaining to go on to interviews with both the Civil Service Commission and command officers in the department. 10 to 15 people pass the interviews and move on to the background check, psych evaluations, and polygraph test. All in all, only 2 or 3 people will make it through this process and actually be hired by the Rogers Police Department. But you're not done yet. A new officer will be sent to one of 2 police academies in the state, either in Camden or Elm Springs. The academies are run by the state of Arkansas, but they do use a lot of local police officers to teach classes. It's actually a lot of classroom work, learning different laws, the math and physics of accident investigation, and evidently, it's nothing like the 1984 film Police Academy. Foster tells people if the only thing you know about law enforcement is what you see on TV and in the movies, then you don't know anything about law enforcement at all. That's just Hollywood.
I've seen talking dogs and flying cats in the movies. It doesn't mean they're really there. So don't believe that stuff that you see in the theater. It's never accurate.
Foster says he can't watch serious police dramas like Law & Order or CSI because he nitpicks them too much. But he does like the funny ones, like Super Troopers. New officers don't just hit the road as soon as they graduate from the police academy. They ride along with the training officer, observing their actions and watching them take the theory of doing the job and applying that theory. Over the 3-month period, new officers spend time with a few different training officers, all the while receiving reviews and evaluations of their own work. Officer Foster says one of the great things about entering law enforcement is this is all paid training.
You know, if you want to go learn a lot of occupations, you've got to spend your time and money to go do that, right? So you want to be a teacher. Well, you got to spend your money to go to university, get your teaching degree. You want to be a plumber or electrician. You got to spend your time and your money to go and learn those skills and those trades. Well, with us, once you make it through that hiring process and the interview process, and we go ahead and hire you, from that moment on, you're being paid. You're a paid employee of the department. We pay to send you to training. We buy all your equipment. We buy your uniforms. You get insurance. You're collecting vacation. All that stuff. You're fully employed by us at that point.
So where does a cop learn that authoritative attitude?
You know, I keep thinking of Cartman from South Park. I'm a cop and you will respect my authority. No, there's no training on that. We don't have a classroom for it. But you do have to have, you know, we call it that command presence. And you're on the scene and it's chaos and it's crazy. You've got to be that solid, steady person. And so, you know, I've said before, you know, we don't really have a sense of humor, which isn't true. We have a sense of humor about stuff, but we're trying to do everything right.
Communications officer Keith Foster was 30 when he became an officer of the law. Having been in the Army, law enforcement seemed a good fit. An entry-level police officer examination will be given at the Rogers Police Department February 6th. To be eligible to test, applications must be turned in by January 27th at 4 p.m. For more information about a career with the Rogers Police Department, visit the website rogersarkansas.com/police.
It is Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
Got any Scottish ancestry?
A little.
Do you know you're tartan?
No.
No?
No. No.
Is that like your family crest?
Well, it's like your plaid. Hmm. Your kilt is a particular tartan.
No, I don't think I have that much Scottish ancestry. Yeah.
Well, you can go find out about all of this because it is Burns Night again.
Haggis for all.
At St. Paul's?
At St. Paul's. Mm-hmm. And poetry by Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland, Scotland's favorite son. They really like him still.
Yes, they do.
He's been dead a very long time and they still get very excited about him.
Every year.
And, of course, the Ozark Highlanders Pipe Band will be involved in this event at St. Paul's where they will read the Ode to the Haggis.
Will they have haggis there? Do you know? Some years they do, and I think some years they don't.
I don't know if they do this year or not. I know that every year we talk about it's this delicious traditional Scottish peasant's dish.
I don't know if we say it's delicious. I have never had it.
I haven't either.
Well, then you don't know if it's delicious or not.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's made out of the
inside. I may live another 50 years and not know, is also what I'm saying.
Do you eat crawfish?
Yes, I do.
Those are delicious.
Those are.
And what could be more interesting
than
a crawfish?
You're absolutely right. It's all in perception. You're right.
Haggis is the organ meat of a sheep, and it's ground up with oatmeal and spices. And the reason that the peasants got haggis was because
you made do.
You may do, and the people above you in stature got the good stuff.
Right.
Anyway, a piper brings in the cook bearing the haggis. Then they read the address to a haggis and some of Robert Burns' work, and people wear kilts, and it'll be fun. And it's 6 o'clock on the 25th, which is Saturday, at St. Paul's in Fayetteville. And tickets are $30. You really must call because it usually sells out. 521-5611.
Thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night from 10 till midnight. On the Friday edition of Shades of Jazz, I'll kick off the show with an exclusive interview with Dr. Lonnie Smith, master of the Hammond B3 organ. He'll be performing with his trio here in Fayetteville February 1st, and I was able to reach him at his home in Florida. He'll discuss his beginnings in the music back in the early 60s, his work with George Benson and Lou Donaldson and more. I'll also feature some brand new CDs just in from Tim Haggerty, Barry Elms, and Rotem Savan. All this and more on Shades of Jazz this Friday at 10.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Chester.
Chester.
We had the story. We had the story on today about signs, and one of the most intimidating signs that's ever been up in our region. Before 540 was built, you'd go on Old 71, and you'd hit that really curvy part, and there would be that warning sign that you know, in the past 3 years, X number of people have died on this highway. Don't you be next. Man, nothing made me, not that I'm a speed demon anyway, but
right.
Nothing
no,
made me lighten up on the gas pedal. And that was always around where you'd think about Chester.
I was going to say I've never been to Chester, but I think I have driven down Old 71. So.
Well, now, you have to get off of 540 or 71 to get to Chester.
Right.
It's, you should go. There's not a lot there, but it's worth a trip.
Worth a visit.
Yes, absolutely.
If you're just kind of moseying down 540.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, this is Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
You're back on tomorrow
with Antoinette.
And I should say that we heard the Film Fest story earlier. It's the inaugural Eureka Springs Film Fest. And
right.
Also this weekend in Eureka Springs is the inaugural Osmomu.
Ozark Mountain Music Festival.
Right.
All indoors, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. As it's, what, 27 degrees as we talk now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a band that I interviewed will be part of the Ozark Mountain Music Fest this weekend, and they're on tomorrow's show.
Yes, looking forward to this very much.
Yes, yeah. So that's why I bring that up. Mm-hmm. And then to end the show this evening, some music of not the band that's coming on tomorrow, but this evening I'm going to the Walton Arts Center to see a 10 by 10 performance of Company Kafig.
It should be really interesting and really fun.
I'm excited about it. I saw some pictures on Facebook today of the workshop that they did last night, and there were some kids, and really, really just these guys look like they're good dancers and good people. So,
yeah.
We end with some Brazilian music that I believe they dance to.
And it's by Sergio Mendes, correct?
Yes. Yep.
Very good.